This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The School for Good and Evil, Number 4, Quest for Glory, by Soman Chainani, performed by Polly Lee. For Ali and Brendan. Part 1. Chapter 1. Agatha. The Almost Queen. When you spend most of your life planning your ever after with a girl, it feels strange to be planning your wedding to a boy. A boy who'd been avoiding Agatha for months. She couldn't sleep, dread brewing in her stomach. Her mind flurried with all the things left to do before the big day, but that wasn't the real reason she was still awake. No, it was something else. A memory of the boy she was about to marry. A memory she couldn't bear to think about. Tedros, stained with tears and slung over a man's shoulder. Tedros unleashing a primal scream so pained and shattering that sometimes Agatha could hear nothing else. She rolled over, burying her head under a pillow. It had been 6 months since that day, the day of the coronation. She hadn't slept well since. Agatha felt Reaper tossing tetchily at the foot of the bed, her restlessness keeping him up. Agatha sighed, feeling sorry for him, and tried to focus on her breaths. Little by little, her mind began to ease. She was always better when she was doing something to help someone else, even if it was falling asleep to spare her bald, mashed-up cat. If only she could do something to help her prince, too, Agatha thought. Together, they always managed to work things out. Click. Her heart stopped. The door. She listened closely, hearing Reaper's soft snores and the sound of the latch creaking open. Agatha pretended to sleep, as her hand inched forward, probing for the knife on her night table. She'd kept the knife there ever since she'd arrived at Camelot. She had to. Tedros earned enemies here long before he'd come to take his place as king. Even if these enemies were in jail now, they had spies everywhere, desperate to kill him and his future queen. And now, the door to her chamber was opening. No one was allowed in her hall at this hour. No one was allowed in her wing. Moonlight spilled onto her back through the cracked open door. Her breaths shallowed as she heard footsteps muffle against the marble floor. A shadow crept up her neck, stretching onto the bedsheets. Agatha gripped the knife harder. Slowly, a weight sank into the mattress behind her. Hold, she told herself. The weight grew heavier. Closer. Hold. She could hear its breath. Hold. The shadow reached for her. Now, With a gasp, Agatha swiveled, swinging the knife for the intruder's neck before he seized her wrist and pinned her to the bed, the knife a millimeter from his throat. Agatha panted with terror as she and the intruder stared into the wide whites of each other's eyes. In the dark, it was all she could see of him, but now she felt the heat of his skin and smelled his fresh, dewy sweat, and all the fear seeped out of her body. Bit by bit, she let him pry the knife away before he exhaled and dropped into the pillow beside her. It all happened so fast, so softly, that Reaper never stirred. She waited for him to speak, or pull her to his chest, or tell her why he'd been avoiding her all this time. Instead, he just curled into a ball against her, whimpering like a tired dog. Agatha stroked his silky hair, mopping up the sweat on his temples with her fingertips, and let him sniffle into her nightgown. She'd never seen him cry. Not like this, so scared and defeated. But as she held him, his breaths settled, his body surrendering to her touch. And he glanced up at her, with the faintest of smiles. Then his smile vanished. Someone was watching them, a tall, turbaned woman looming in the doorway, her gleaming teeth gnashed tight. And just like that, Tedros was gone, as quick as he came. Splinters of August sun streamed through the window onto the chandelier, refracting light into Agatha's eyes. Blinking groggily, she could see missing crystals in the chandelier, covered in cobwebs like an old gravestone. She hugged her pillow to her chest. It still smelled like him. Reaper slithered up from the foot of the bed, sniffing at the pillow, poised to slash it to shreds, before Agatha shot him a look. Her cat slunk back to the foot of the bed. "He's improving at least," Agatha thought. The first night in the castle, he'd peed in Tedros's shoe. Voices echoed in her wing. She wouldn't be alone much longer. Agatha sat up in her baggy black nightgown, peering at her room. It was three times the size of her old house in Gavaldon, with dusty gem-crusted mirrors, a sagging settee, and a 200-year-old desk of ivory and bone. Clutching her pillow like a life raft, she soaked in the quiet coming off the cracked marble tiles dyed robin's egg blue, and the matching walls inlaid with mottled gold flowers. The Queen's Chamber was like everything at Camelot, royal from afar, tarnished up close. This applied to her, too. She was living in the Queen's quarters, but she wasn't even Queen yet. The wedding was still 2 months away. A wedding that was making her uneasier each day. Once upon a time, Agatha had imagined she'd live happily ever after with Sophie in Gavaldon. The two of them would be proud owners of a cottage in town, where they'd have tea and toast each morning, then jaunt off to Mr. Deauville's storybook shop, now the A&S bookshop, since she and Sophie would take it over once the old man died. After work, she'd help pick herbs and flowers that Sophie would use to make her beauty creams, before they'd visit Agatha's mother on Graves Hill for dinners of lamb brain stew and lizard quiche. Steamed prunes and cucumbers for Sophie, of course. How ordinary their life would be together. How happy. Friendship was all they needed. Agatha squeezed the pillow harder. How things change. Now, her mother was dead, Sophie was Dean of Evil at Magical School, and Agatha was marrying King Arthur's son. No one was more excited about the wedding than Sophie, who'd sent letter after letter from her faraway castle with sketches of dresses and cakes and china that she insisted Agatha use for her big day. "Dear Aggie, I haven't heard back from you about the chiffon veil swatches I sent or the proposed canapes. Really, darling, if you don't want my help, just tell me." Agatha could see these letters piled on the desk, coated in spidery trails of dust. Every day she told herself she would answer them, but she never did. And the worst part was, she didn't know why. Footsteps grew louder outside her room. Agatha's stomach churned. It had been this way for 6 months. She felt more and more anxious, while Tedros grew more and more withdrawn. Last night was the closest they'd come to speaking about what happened on Coronation Day, and neither of them had even said a word. She knew he was embarrassed, devastated, ashamed. But she couldn't help him if he didn't talk to her. And he couldn't talk to her if he was never with her. More voices now, more footsteps. Mouth dry, Agatha snatched the glass of water from her night table. Empty. So was the pitcher. Reaper slid off the bed, prowling towards the faded double doors. She needed time alone with Tedros. Time where they weren't living separate lives. Time where they could be honest and intimate with each other like they used to be. Time where they could be themselves again. The doors crashed open, and four maids paraded in, each wearing the same draping robe in a different shade of pastel. Peach, pistachio, grapefruit, rose. As if they were a box of mixed macaron. They were led by a tall, tan woman, in lavender, with dark, smoky eyes, shiny red lipstick, and wild black hair barely cooped by a turban. She carried a leather-bound notebook in one hand, and in the other, a feather pen so long it looked like a whip.
"Breakfast with the wedding florist at 7 in the Blue Tower dining room. Then meetings with tailor candidates in 20-minute intervals to decide who should stitch the wedding linens. Then an interview with the Camelot Courier for their wedding preview edition. At 9, you'll visit the Camelot Zoo to pick the official wedding doves. They have several species, each a varying shade of white."
Agatha could barely listen because Peach and Pistachio had hoisted her out of bed and were already scrubbing her with scalding towels, while Grapefruit shoved a toothbrush in her mouth and Rose smeared her face with an array of potions like Sophie used to do, only without Sophie's charisma or humour.
"Then a signing of The Tale of Sophie and Agatha, at Books and Crannies, to raise funds for the castle's plumbing renovation."
The lavender woman continued in a crisp, posh accent.
"Followed by a lunch fundraiser at the Spancel Club, where you'll read a storybook to children of rich patrons whose donations will repair the drawbridge."
"Lady Gremlane, is there time for me to see Tedros today?" muffled Agatha beneath a blue gown the women were tugging over her head. "We haven't had a meal alone in ages."
"After lunch, you'll begin waltz lessons to prepare for your wedding dance, then etiquette training so you don't make a mess of yourself at the wedding feast, and finally, history class, about the triumphs and disasters of royal weddings past, so that yours might end in the annals of the first rather than the last."
Lady Gremlane finished. Agatha gritted her teeth as her maids fussed with her hair and makeup like the nymphs in the groom room used to. Dancing, etiquette, history? It's the school for good all over again. Only at school, I actually had time with my prince. Lady Gremlane raised her eyes to Agatha. She snapped her book shut so sharply a gemstone fell out of the mirror.
Well, since you have no further questions, your chambermaids here will see that you get to your breakfast on time, she said, turning for the door. The king needs me by his side every possible moment.
I'd like to see Tedros today, Agatha insisted. Please add it to my schedule. Lady Gremlane stopped cold and turned, her lips a tight red slash. The chambermaid subtly backed away from Agatha.
I'd say you saw more than enough of him last night. Against the rules, said Lady Gremlane. A king cannot be alone in your room before the wedding.
Tedros should have the right to see me whenever he wishes, said Agatha. I am his queen.
Not yet, princess, said Lady Gremlane coolly.
I will be after the wedding, Agatha challenged, which I spend all my time planning like some brainless biddy when I'd rather be with Tedros, helping him run the kingdom of which he is now king. And seeing that you're chief steward in service to the king and future queen, surely that's something you can arrange.
I see,
said Lady Gremlane, moving towards Agatha.
The castle is crumbling. Your king wears a crown still in dispute. You have spies plotting to kill you. The former queen and her traitorous knight have been in hiding since the coronation, and the Royal Rot, a rogue publication intent on overthrowing the monarchy, calls you, amongst other things, a gilded celebrity from an amateur fairy tale destined to bring more shame to Tedros than his own mother once did.
Lady Gremlane smiled, lording over Agatha.
And here you are, still pining for your days at school and a little kissy time in the hall with the class captain.
No, that's not it at all. I want to help him, Agatha retorted, enduring the onslaught of her steward's perfume. I'm fully aware of the problems we face, but Tedros and I are supposed to be a team.
Then why hasn't he ever asked to see you?
Said Lady Gremlane. Agatha flinched.
In fact, except for his momentary lapse last night, which he assured me will never happen again, the king hasn't mentioned your name once.
Lady Gremlane added. Agatha said nothing.
You see, I'm afraid King Tedros has better things to do, trying to bring Camelot out of shame, in time for the wedding.
Lady Gremlane went on.
A wedding that must be so magnificent, so memorable, so inspiring, that it will erase all doubts that rose from that humiliating coronation. And it is a wedding that, per thousands of years of tradition, is up to the future queen to plan. That's your job. That's how you can help your king.
She leaned in, her nose almost touching Agatha's.
But if you would like me to tell King Tedros that you find your responsibilities beneath you, and that you have questioned every one of our decisions down to the colours of your wardrobe, the importance of baths, and your choice of footwear, and now on top of that, would like him to interrupt his urgent efforts to prove his place as king so he can make you feel part of a team, Then by all means, princess. Let's see what he has to say.
Agatha swallowed, her neck rashing red, her eyes drifted down to her clumps. No. That's okay. I'm sure I'll see him tomorrow, she said softly, looking back up. But Lady Gremlin was gone, and all that was left were her pastel minions ready to whisk the princess to a breakfast she would have no time to eat. Halfway through the day, Agatha was about to turn runaway bride. She'd endured weeks of this with a forced smile, the same deadly dull routine of inspecting 1,000 place cards and cakes and candles and centerpieces, even though they all looked the same to her, and she'd be happy marrying Tedros in a bat cave. She'd prefer it, actually. No room for guests. Interspersed with all this tedium were appearances for Camelot Beautiful, a queen-led campaign to raise funds for the broken-down castle that had been left to blight after King Arthur had died. Agatha believed in the cause wholeheartedly and had a high tolerance for nonsense. She was friends with Sophie, after all. But Lady Gremlin seemed determined to humiliate her with each day's schedule. Whether making her sing the anthem at the Woods Rugby Cup, even the Camelot team covered their ears, or ride a bull at the Spring Fair, it bucked her into a mound of poo, or kiss the highest bidder in a Smooch the Princess auction. A toothless hoodlum who Lady Gremlin insisted had won fair and square. Guinevere had warned Agatha to expect resistance from her new warden. Lady Gremlin had been chief steward when Guinevere was Arthur's wife, until she and Guinevere had a falling out and Guinevere had her dismissed. But after Guinevere's disappearance and Arthur's death, his council of advisers took over Camelot since Tedros wasn't yet 16, and these advisers brought Lady Gremlin back. Now, with Guinevere returned to the castle, surely Gremlin would be prickling to exert control over Guinevere's son and his new queen. Even worse, the old fusspot couldn't be fired until Tedros's coronation was sealed. Knowing this, Agatha had tried to befriend her steward, but Lady Gremlin hated her at first sight. Agatha had no idea why, but clearly the woman didn't want her marrying Camelot's king. It was as if Lady Gremlin thought if she just tried hard enough, Agatha would give up her groom before the wedding. "I'd sooner die," Agatha vowed. For the last 6 months, she'd woken up each morning ready for the fight. But today was the day that broke her. First, there was the florist, who shoved Agatha's face in so many effluvious bouquets over the course of an hour that she'd left red-eyed and nose-dripping. Next, there were the 6 tailors, who showed her dozens of linens that looked exactly the same. Then came the reporter from the Camelot Courier, a miserably cheerful young girl named Bettina, who arrived sucking a red lollipop.
"Lady Gremlin already scripted all your answers, so let's have an off-the-record chat for fun," she diddled, before launching into an array of startlingly personal questions about Agatha's relationship with Tedros. "What does he wear when he sleeps? Does he have a nickname for you? Do you ever catch him looking at other girls?"
"No," Agatha said to the last, about to add, "especially not fart bubbles like you." But she held her tongue through nearly an hour of this, before she'd had enough.
"So, do you and Tedros want children?" Bettina wisped.
"Why, Are you looking for parents? Agatha snapped. The meeting was over after that. She nearly lost her temper again at the Spancel Club fundraiser when she had to read The Lion and the Snake, a famous Camelot storybook, to rich, bratty children who kept interrupting her because they already knew the story. Now, in her carriage after picking wedding doves at the zoo, Agatha slumped over in her sweaty gown, thinking of the waltz and etiquette lessons ahead, and sucked back tears. "The king hasn't mentioned your name once," Lady Gremlane echoed. She'd tried to pretend that the meddling bat had lied, but Agatha knew she hadn't. Even when Agatha had run into Tedros in the castle these past few months, he'd tell her how pretty she looked, or prattle something inane about the weather, or ask her if she was comfortable in her quarters before shuttling away like a spooked squirrel. Last night, in her room, was the first time she'd seen him without a flushed, plastic smile on his face that told her not to ask how he was doing, because he was doing just fine. But he wasn't fine, of course, and she didn't know how to help him. Agatha dabbed at her eyes. She had come to Camelot for Tedros, to be his queen, to stand by him in his finest and darkest hours. But instead, they were both alone, fending for themselves. It was clear he needed her. That's why he'd crawled into her arms last night. So why couldn't he just admit it? She knew deep down it wasn't her fault, but she still couldn't help feeling rejected and hurt. Reaper curled up in her lap, reminding her he was there. She rubbed his bald head. If only we could go back to our graveyard before we ever thought about boys. Reaper spat in agreement. Agatha gazed out the window of her blue and gold carriage as it rolled into Maker's Market, the main thoroughfare of Camelot City. Given the conditions of its roads, her driver normally avoided it and took the longer route back to the castle, but they were already running late for her wedding waltz lesson, and she didn't want to make a poor impression on her new teacher. Dirt kicked up around the carriage from unpaved streets, clouding her view of the bright-coloured tents, each carrying a flag with Camelot's crest, two eagles flanking the sword Excalibur on a blue shield. But as the dust cleared, Agatha noticed a stark divide between the rich villagers in expensive coats and jewels as they shopped along the main street, and the thousands of grimy, skeletal peasants living in crumbling shanties in the alleyways adjoining the market. Royal guards patrolled these slums, forcefully blocking any peasants who drew too close to wealthy patrons entering or leaving the tents. Agatha slid down her window to get a better view, but her driver rapped his horsewhip on the glass.
"Lay low, milady," he said.
Agatha pushed the window back up. When she first rode into her new kingdom 6 months ago, she'd seen the same slum cities smack in the middle of Camelot. As Tedros explained then, his father had led Camelot to a golden age, where every citizen improved his or her fortune. But upon Arthur's death, his advisers had allied with the rich, passing shady laws to reclaim land and wealth from the middle class, plunging them into poverty. Tedros had vowed to undo these laws and resettle those without homes, but in the past half year, the divide between rich and poor had only gotten worse. Why hadn't he succeeded? Had he not seen how far his father's legacy had fallen? How could he let his own kingdom languish like this? If she was king... Agatha exhaled. But she wasn't, was she? She wasn't even queen yet. And from the way Tedros acted last night, he was clearly frustrated too. He was managing Camelot by himself, and had no one to help him. Not her, not his father, not his mother, not Lancelot, not even Merlin. The last three of who'd been gone for the past 6 months.
Splat!
A black, mashed hunk of food hit the window. Agatha spun to see a filthy peasant yell,
"So-called king and his almost queen!"
Suddenly, others in the slum city spotted her carriage and globbed onto the chant, "So-called king and his almost queen!" while pelting her vehicle with food, shoes, and handfuls of dirt. Her driver beat the horses harder, racing them out of the market. Blood boiling, Agatha wanted to leap out of the carriage and tell those goons that none of this was her or Tedros's fault. Not the slum cities, not the coronation, not a once legendary kingdom gone to shambles. How would that help anything? Agatha scolded herself. If she was starving in the streets, wouldn't she blame herself and Tedros too? They were the ones in power now, even if they hadn't caused the kingdom's fall. The poor and suffering had no time for the past, only for progress. But this wasn't school anymore, where progress could be charted with rankings and a scoreboard. This was real life, and despite the dismal results thus far, they were two teenagers trying to be good leaders. Or Tedros was, surely. She was on her way to dancing lessons. Agatha sulked as the carriage rumbled up the hill towards the bone-white gates of Camelot, which the royal guards pulled open for their arrival. It didn't matter that the gates were streaked with rust or the towers ahead faded by weather and soot. Camelot Castle was still a magnificent sight, built into jagged grey cliffs over the savage sea. Under the August sun, the white spires took on a liquid sheen, capped with rounded blue turrets that speared through low-flying clouds. The carriage stopped short of a gap in the cliffs leading to the castle's entrance.
"Drawbridge is still broken from the coronation, milady," the driver sighed, pulling into a carriage house at the edge of the cliff. "We'll have to use the ropes to cross."
Agatha barreled out of the carriage herself before the driver could open her door. Enough whining, she thought as she wobbled along the unsteady rope bridge that even honored guests had to use until the embarrassing drawbridge problem could be fixed. Tedros wasn't haggling over when they would have time alone. Tedros wasn't hounding her about being a team. Tedros was working for his people, like she should be. Maybe Lady Gremlane was right, Agatha confessed. Maybe she should stop obsessing over what she couldn't do as queen and start focusing on the one thing she could. Indeed, a wedding filled with love and beauty and intention might be just the way to restore the kingdom's faith in them after the coronation. A wedding could show everyone that Camelot's best days were to come, that her and Tedros's ever after had brought them here for a reason, that they could find a happy ending not just as king and queen, but for the people too, even those who'd lost hope. Head held high, Agatha marched back into the castle, eager for her wedding lessons now and determined to do her very best. That is, until she found out who was teaching them. Chapter 2. Tedros. How not to throw a coronation. Though he had no time for himself, no time for Agatha, no time at all, Tedros refused to get soft. In his knee-length black socks and cut-off breeches, he snuck through the dark, muggy halls of Gold Tower, a towel slung over his bare, tanned chest. He knew it was vain and obsessive, this getting up at 4:30 to exercise, but it felt like the only thing left he could actually control. Because at 6 on the dot, Lady Gremlane and 4 male stewards would barge into his room, and from that moment until he slogged back into bed at night, he was no longer in charge of his own life. He passed Agatha's room, tempted to slip in and wake her up. But he'd gotten in trouble for that last night, and he didn't need any more trouble. His kingdom was already on the verge of revolt. That's why he'd ceded Lady Gremlane total control over the castle. As Arthur's once steward, she was a known face and gave people faith that the new king would be well managed. But there was another reason he'd let Gremlane keep him on a tight leash. One he could never say out loud. Tedros didn't trust himself as king. He needed someone like Lady Gremlane who could watch his every move, who would check his every decision. If he'd only listened to her at the coronation, none of this would have happened. But he was listening to her now. Because if there was one thing he knew, it was that there could be no more mistakes. Last night had already been a serious blunder. Lady Gremlane had warned him not to repeat his father's errors and let a girl interfere with his duties as king. Tedros took this warning seriously. Up until yesterday, he'd done well to concentrate on his tasks and let Agatha concentrate on hers. Even if it meant he'd had more freedom to see Agatha at school than he did now as king in his own castle. But then he'd gone and snuck into her room dead tired, defences down, and acted like a snivelling child. Tedros cringed, replaying the moment in his head. He'd brought Agatha to Camelot, away from everyone and everything she knew, and he wanted her to feel safe and taken care of. He couldn't let her see how weak and scared he was. He couldn't let her see that all he wanted to do was run away with her, to hold her tight and shut the world out. But that's exactly what he had done last night. And for the fleeting relief he'd found in her arms, he left his future queen anxious and worried for him, and his steward angry and disappointed.
"Stop acting like a boy," Tedros chastised himself. "Act like a king."
So today he let Agatha sleep, even if it left a big black hole in his heart. Tedros scuttled through the hall's colossal gold passage and soaring arches, sweat sopping his wavy blonde hair, his breeches sticking to his thighs. He couldn't remember the castle ever feeling this stifling. 2 mice darted past him into a hole in the plaster. A procession of ants wove around the friezes of famous knights on the wall, now damaged and missing limbs. When his father and mother were king and queen, this hall used to be minty clean, even in the August doldrums. Now, it smelled like dead cat.
Down 3 flights he went, socks slippery on dull gold stone, before he hustled through the gymnasium, a lavish collection of training equipment, surrounded by weapons and armour from Camelot's history, enclosed in glass cases. One would assume this was Tedros's destination, but instead he scurried right through, his pure blue eyes pinned to the dusty floor, trying not to look at the large glass case in the centre of the room. The one case that happened to be empty. Its placard read, Excalibur. He was still thinking about that large empty case when he arrived at King's Cove, a sunken bathing pool in the bowels of the castle. When he was a young prince, this man-made grotto had flowering vines around tall piles of rock and a steaming hot waterfall. The balmy water once shimmered with 1,000 purple and pink lights from fairies who tended the pool in exchange for safe shelter at Camelot. Tedros remembered his mornings here as a child, racing the fairies around his father's statue at the centre of the pool, his tiny opponents lighting up the water like fireworks. King's Cove was different now. The pool was dark and cold, the water algae green. The plants were dead, the waterfall a drip, drip, drip. The fairies were gone too, banished from the castle by Arthur after Guinevere and Merlin had both abandoned him, destroying Arthur's faith in magic. Tedros looked down at the kettlebells he'd stolen from the gym and stashed by the pool, along with a sad, lowly rope he'd tied to the ceiling to practice climbing. He couldn't exercise in that other room. Not if he had to be near that empty case, and think about where the sword was now. Slowly, his eyes rose to his father's statue in the murky pool, caked with moss and dirt. King Arthur, Excalibur in hand, staring down at him. Only he wasn't staring, at least not any more. His eyes were gone. Violently gouged out, leaving 2 big black holes. Tedros endured a wave of guilt, more intense than the one he'd felt in the gym. He'd done it. He'd carved out his own father's eyes because he couldn't bear the old king looking at him after what happened at the coronation. "I'll fix it, Father," he vowed. "I'll fix everything." Tedros tossed his towel onto the mildewed floor and dove into the pool, thoughts wiped out by the harsh, stabbing cold. 6 months before, the day of the coronation had been brilliant and warm. Tedros was utterly spent after everything that had happened leading up to it, reconciling with his mother, fighting a war against an evil schoolmaster, and making an all-night ride from school to Camelot in time for him to be crowned king the next day. And yet, despite feeling like a sore, sleepless zombie, he couldn't stop smiling. After so many false starts and twists and turns, he'd finally found his ever after. He was the ruler of the most legendary kingdom in the woods. He'd have Agatha by his side forever. His mother and Lancelot would live with them in the castle. For the first time since he was a child, he had a full family again. And soon, a queen to share it with. Any one of those would be a wonderful enough gift on this, his 16th birthday. But the best present of all? Sophie, his old friend-enemy princess-witch, had been appointed dean at the school for evil far, far away, where she'd remain at a safe distance from him and Agatha. Which meant no more Sophie thuggery, no more Sophie skullduggery for the rest of their lives. He'd learned from experience that he and that girl couldn't be in the same place without killing each other, kissing each other, or a lot of people ending up dead.
Can't Merlin do a spell to make this smell better?
Tedros said in front of his bedroom mirror, sniffing at his father's old robes.
This thing is rancid. Whole castle is rancid,
groused Lancelot, gnawing on a slab of dried beef.
And I haven't seen Merlin since he hopped out of the carriage in Maidenvale, said he'd meet us at the castle. Should be here by now.
Merlin runs on his own time,
Guinevere sighed, sitting next to Lancelot on her son's bed.
He'll be here soon. Can't possibly miss my coronation,
Tedros said, holding his nose.
Maybe if we spritz this with a little cologne.
It's a coronation gown, Teddy. You only have to wear it once, said his mother. Besides, I don't smell anything, except whatever it is Lance raided from the pantry.
Oh, be serious, Gwen,
Lancelot growled, smacking at the bedsheets and spawning a dust storm.
What happened to this place? Don't worry. Agatha and I will fix everything,
Tedros declared, combing his hair.
We knew what we were coming back to. Dad's advisers let the castle go to waste and lined their pockets with the kingdom's taxes. Would have loved to have seen their faces when Lance threw them in the dungeons. Oddly calm, to be honest. As if they expected it, or at least knew better than to fight.
Lance said with a loud belch.
Insisted I don't have the authority to jail them until Tedros is king. Told them to sod off.
They're right, Guinevere clipped. And if you can't eat like a proper human, I'll have the kitchen put you on a vegetable diet.
Tedros and Lancelot gaped at her.
They're right?
Tedros asked incredulously.
Vegetables?
Lancelot blurted, mouth full.
Until your coronation as king is official, the Council of Advisers appointed by Arthur has full authority to decide who runs Camelot, Guinevere explained. But in a few hours you will be king, and it's not like there's a rival with a claim to the throne they can summon out of thin air. That's why the guards didn't stop Lance from jailing them.
Reassured, Tedros went back to assessing his reflection.
Darling, enough with the mirror. You look beautiful, his mother said. Meanwhile, poor Agatha is getting ready by herself and surely needs a lady's help. Why don't I go to her and leave you here with Lance?
Agatha's fine,
Tedros said, picking at an annoying pimple near his mouth. God, I'm almost as bad as Sophie, he thought. But he was about to have an entire kingdom judging him. Who wouldn't be self-conscious?
Besides, it's my birthday, he added, and I want to spend time with my mother.
He saw his mother blush, still unused to him being nice to her.
Sounds more like little kings afraid of being alone with me,
Lancelot cracked.
Call me little again and I'll run you through.
Tedros flared, tapping Excalibur on his waist.
No one on earth would choose to be alone with you anyway. Except your mother. Likes our alone time just fine,
said Lancelot tartly.
Oh, good Lord,
Guinevere mumbled.
In any case,
Agatha has that strange steward woman helping her get ready, the one who greeted us when we arrived last night and reeks of perfume. Said Tedros, checking his teeth. Wanted to help me get ready, but I said I had you two. Didn't seem happy about it. What's the story there, Gwen? Looked about as thrilled to see you as you did her, said Lancelot.
There is no story. She was my steward until after Tedros was born. I had her dismissed. Now she's back, Guinevere said curtly.
Well, clearly something happened between you two.
Nothing happened.
Then why are you making the same face about her as you made around Millie?
Who's Millie? Tedros asked.
A horny goat that used to chase your mother around the farm, Lancelot said.
Guinevere kicked him.
God, you two had a lot of free time out there, Tedros muttered into the mirror.
Lady Gremlane is irrelevant, said Guinevere, sobering. A steward only has responsibility over a prince until his coronation. After you seal your coronation, you're in charge, and can remove Lady Gremlane from the castle once and for all.
So what does that mean? Seal my coronation? I repeat a few vows and give a speech?
Tedros asked, finally tired of looking at himself. He plopped on a sooty armchair next to the bed. His mother frowned. You said you knew what happened at a coronation.
That you didn't need a lecture from us, sniped Lancelot.
Well, is there something special about the speech I should know about?
Tedros said impatiently.
There is no speech, you twit,
Lancelot retorted. Tedros blinked.
Then when do I introduce you two as part of my royal court?
His mother and Lancelot exchanged looks. Teddy, I don't think that's a good move.
It's the right move, and the right move is the good move,
said Tedros.
It's been years since what happened between you two and Dad. I'm sure the people have moved on.
Lancelot drew a breath.
Tedros, it's not that simple. You're not thinking about all the...
If we live in fear, we'll never get anything done,
said Tedros, cutting him off.
I'll tell this Gremlane woman to seat you on the stage next to me.
I'm sure that will go over well, his mother said cryptically. Lancelot gave her another curious look, but Guinevere didn't elaborate. Tedros let the point go. From his one interaction with Lady Gremlane, he was confident his new steward would abide by his wishes.
So if there's no speech, then what is there?
He asked, reclining against the chair. The chaplain will swear you in and make you repeat your vows in front of the kingdom, his mother said. Then you have to complete a ceremonial test. Tedros's eyes widened.
Like those written tests we had in good deeds class.
You really are clueless, Lancelot grouched. It's a test of your father's choosing, written in his will and revealed at the coronation.
Pfft, Dad told me about that. That's not a test, Tedros scoffed. It's a token gesture. Said he'd never pick something I couldn't do, that he'd pick something to make me look as strong and commanding before my people as possible.
Make you look strong and commanding? That's a test in itself,
Lancelot murmured. Guinevere glared at him and moved next to her son.
So I have to perform the test Dad left for me, Tedros said, and then I'm king.
Then you're king, his mother smiled, ruffling his hair. Tedros smiled back, his heart light as a cloud,
even though he'd have to comb his hair again.
But first, there's dancing monkeys, said Lancelot.
Oh, hush, said Guinevere, chortling. Tedros glanced between them.
Very funny.
His mother was still laughing.
Very funny,
Tedros repeated.
Presenting the Mahaba Monkeys of Malabar Hills,
the courtier shouted. A cannon blew confetti on the crowd and the people cheered, at least 50,000 of them, packed onto the hills beneath the castle. Per tradition, the drawbridge had been lowered, inviting citizens of Camelot onto royal grounds. They'd been crossing over since the morning to witness the coronation of King Arthur's son, and yet there were still thousands who wouldn't fit, leaving them stranded on the drawbridge or below the cliffs, peering up at the castle balcony and the beautiful stone stage built for the occasion. Sitting on stage, however, Tedros knew full well it wasn't stone. It was cheap, rickety wood, masked with paint that made it look like stone, and it creaked hideously under the weight of his father's throne. Even worse, hot wax dripped onto his sweltering robes from wobbly candelabras they'd nicked from the castle chapel to save on ceremonial torches. Still, he'd kept his mouth shut. Camelot was broke, and splurging on a coronation would be irresponsible. But now, watching hapless performers from neighboring realms, he was beginning to lose patience. First, there was a fire-eater from Jaunt Jolie, who accidentally set her dress aflame. Then a tone-deaf chanteuse from Foxwood, who forgot the lyrics to God Save the King. Then two portly young brothers from Avonlea, who fell off a flying trapeze into the crowd. And now, apes.
If they weren't trying so hard, I'd think they were mocking me,
Tedros grumbled, itching under his robes.
I'm afraid the more skilled acts were out of budget, Lady Gremlane said from her seat beside him, sipping at a goblet of sparkling water. We did pay for the monkeys, however. They were your father's favourite.
Tedros peered downstage at the six monkeys in red sequined fedoras, scratching their privates and wagging their bums out of sync.
Was this before or after he started drinking?
Tedros said. Lady Gremlane didn't laugh. Agatha would have, he thought peevishly. Not only that, but for a woman who'd been determined to spend time with him, Lady Gremlane didn't seem to like him much. When they first met last night, he'd assumed she thought him handsome and charming and would do anything he asked. But now that they were seated together, she kept throwing him skeptical looks any time he spoke, as if he had the brain of an oyster. It was undermining his confidence right when he needed it most.
I don't understand why Agatha can't sit here with me, he said, squinting at the royal gallery below on the lawn where she was just a shadow,
cooped up with the dukes, counts, and other titled nobles.
Or my mother, for that matter.
Lady Gremlane straightened her turban.
Agatha is not your queen yet. After your marriage, she can join you at official events. As for your mother, given her and Lancelot's ignominious flight from the castle, I thought it best to keep them out of sight and withhold news of their return until a more appropriate time.
Tedros followed her eyes to a white scrim curtaining off the balcony behind them. Through the scrim,
He could see his mother and Lancelot watching the ceremony with a few maids and kitchen boys.
"It's a wonder news hasn't leaked,"
Lady Gremlin added.
"Lancelot made a spectacle throwing those advisers into the castle jail last night."
"Who cares if it had leaked?" Tedros countered. "The sooner we tell the people my mother